You're listening to episode 353 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Building Psych Strength podcast. My name's Dr. April, and I'm so happy you're here. Today, we're talking about a very important topic. Today, we're talking about romantic relationships. Now, this isn't a topic that we've covered a lot on the podcast. I don't know why, because it's such a fundamental, foundational topic for so many of us. And it's a really neat way that we're covering this topic today. So much about the way that we interact in our relationships, especially our romantic relationships, is almost, call it predetermined or pre-influenced for sure, by things that we learned throughout life up until that point. We've talked a lot about concepts of our familiarity zone or comfort zone that comes into play when our romantic relationships are involved. We've talked about concepts of identity, not identity in terms of roles we play. I am a mother, I am a sister, I am a blah, blah, blah. Not that. But identity in terms of people like me do or don't do certain things. People like me should or shouldn't do certain things. People like me can or can't do certain things. That comes into play here. What we learn from our family of origin and how we think about what love looks like and what we learned about that and what our role is in it, wow, does that come into play here? So it's an interesting way of dissecting such an important part of our life in this conversation that I'm going to share with you today, because it brings into view some influencing factors that you might not have thought of before, truly. And I'll be the first one to say that in my relationship with my husband today, I absolutely saw this at play, but it took a long time to get there. And until I did, I had no idea why I was reacting in the way I was. And I know I'm being a little bit cryptic right now. You just have to listen to this episode. It is just absolutely so powerful. Today, I'm featuring a conversation that I had with Dr. Thomas Jordan. He's a clinical psychologist and psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City. He's on the faculty of NYU's postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis and the author of the book, Learn to Love, Guide to Healing Your Disappointing Love Life. And he's the founder of lovelifelearningcenter.com. Dr. Jordan specializes in the treatment of unhealthy love lives and has been studying them for over 30 years. So, His background and the way that he thinks about how we show up in our romantic relationships is very informed by learning theory. What did we learn about what those relationships mean? What did we learn about our role in them? What did we learn about what is acceptable and unacceptable and familiar and even what's available to us? There's so much depth in this episode. I honestly think I'm going to have him back on because there was so much that we didn't talk about that I was just dying to go into, but I knew it would open up so many rabbit holes and we would not get out of here in under 2 hours. We do get out in under 2 hours, so never fear. But we might have to have him back on because it's such a great episode. So if you are a person who is in a romantic relationship, desires to be in a romantic relationship, is having troubles in one, or wants to make sure that you are building a really good and stable and strong one, this episode is absolutely for you. Enjoy. Tom, I'm so excited that you're here with us for this episode. We're diving into a topic that so many of us need some good info on. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me, April.
You know, when I heard about your work, I got really excited because this isn't something that we dive into much on the podcast, which is shocking because when you think about interpersonal relationships and in particular romantic relationships, they're pretty important in our lives. So tell me a little bit about what got you into this work. What excites you about this work?
Basically three reasons. One is I changed my own love life. back in the 1990s as a course of being, as a result of being in treatment with someone who had a sensitivity about love life issues, helped me realize that what I had learned in my family of origin, I was replicating in my adult love life. And wow. That awareness really blew me away. I took a break from dating, I figured out what the family of origin influences were, and I made some changes. And I've been married now for 28 years. I work with my wife. She's also a psychotherapist. We have a joint practice together. So I wanted to take that experience that I had and distill it into something that can at least get people started along the road of becoming aware of what's going on in their love lives. The second reason is I, in the course of about 34 years of practice here in New York City, I've seen a lot of repetition in people's love lives. Repetition, repetition. And the other word I attach to that is replication. Mm-hmm. Repetition, replication. Repeated disappointments, replicating patterns that were learned earlier in life. And the gap, the disconnect between what went on in the family of origin and how it's being replicated in a person's love life is oftentimes they're just out of touch with it. They're not aware of it. And that can be quite tragic, because I've met with people over the years who've replicated lousy relationships multiple times. And now they're in their 50s and 60s, resigned against love. It's like, you know, forget it. It's too hurtful. And I think that's just a continuous problem. A segue into that is this crazy divorce rate, which bugs me. 50% first marriage, up to 60% second marriage, and a whopping 73% third marriage. Now, you can't convince me that's not making the same mistake over and over again. You cannot convince me that there's not an unconscious process going on there. And I happen to believe, and my research indicates, that it's a learning process that's being replicated. Only problem is, we don't know enough about unconscious learning to really put our finger on that. I mean, we know a bit about implicit learning. This is in the cognitive field. We know a bit about observational learning, imitation theory, social learning issues, and so on. But for some reason, it just seems like there's a bit of a dark area there about how powerfully children can internalize what they observe, what they encounter, what they experience in their families of origin, and how bits and pieces of it, sometimes not the whole thing, how it gets internalized and how it gets replicated. So I think that's extremely important.
That's amazing. You're hitting on a lot of things that we've touched on in different domains in the podcast. I'd love for you to do a little bit of level setting. Tell people, do a little bit of definition or some basics. What do you mean when you say unconscious learning? What do you mean when it applies to, I guess, what we might have picked up about relationships and how they operate, our role in them, when we were younger in our family of origin? Can you just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. In my book, I talk about the disappointing love life. I use that phrase sort of like a condition. I describe it as a condition. And the disappointing love life tends to have repetition, replication, repetition being something happening over and over again, disappointment, replication being what's being replicated from earlier experience unconsciously without awareness. If it's healthy, fine, no problem. If it's unhealthy, that's where the problems come in. Mm-hmm. And then how people recreate it. And I think a learning process is involved in how experience can be recreated. What we believe, how we behave, how we feel, these are all elements of that learned experience that get replicated. And you can see the detail of that looking into people's lives, the patients I've worked with, getting the detail of how they tend to gravitate towards the same kind of people over and over again, mm-hmm. how aspects of family experience are replicated. I'll give you an example. A person came to see me a number of years ago, 50-year-old woman, described in an initial interview how she grew up in a home with an alcoholic father who was physically abusive to their mother. And as siblings, they watched it happen. She grew up, left home, married two men who are alcohol abusers, physically abusive, two alcoholic men, was working on the third. So I asked her somewhat innocently, do you think there's a relationship between what you experienced in the family of origin and these marriages you've had? And this is an intelligent, well-educated woman. She looked at me like, what?
Wow.
Like yeah. She had never really pieced together the two in her mind, in her perception. So in my way of thinking, that's the psychological love life in action. It's working to recreate experience. And in my book, I talk about the psychological love life as having three parts, basically. It has the experiences that have gotten into your mind. Now, I've met people that have grown up in abusive homes, abandonment, neglect, and didn't recreate that in their love life. So it's a little bit complicated. It mm-hmm. depends on the individual mm-hmm. and the experiences. So you got to look into individuals one at a time to really see what gets internalized. It also involves, obviously, what's learned from those experiences. And in my book, I listed 12 unhealthy relationship experiences, the kind of things I saw replicated over and over again: abuse, abandonment, over-control, dishonesty, self-centeredness, neglect, intrusion, dominance, different forms of relationship experience that tend to work their way into people's love life as an adult. And also I include after effects. If your relationship experience growing up has been unhealthy, I find that people try to cope with that without awareness. For example, defensiveness. Defensiveness is a very common way that people try to deal with the fact that relationships have been disappointing. They might try to be in a love relationship at a distance, avoid love relationships entirely, generate conflict all the time, which allows them not to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
Right. Another common after effect is trying to fix your love partner. Oh, I'll make her love me. I'll love her to death and make a good woman out of her. I'll make this guy commit. I know he's been not committed in previous relationships. I'll change him.
I'll be the one who fixes them.
I haven't found the case of anybody changing anybody, and I've been looking, and I'm still looking. And of course, there's also the people who look for partners making multiple changes, like the perfect partner. That's another effort to try to cope. So that psychological love life is what's on the inside that predicts and determines love life experience. And from there, I wanted to put together a simple, straightforward, step-by-step process that people can begin to think about how to unlearn what's been learned that is unhealthy. Mm-hmm. The first step always is consciousness. To identify what is unhealthy is always the first and most important step. If you can tolerate the discomfort of looking into your family of origin, the first most important classroom that we encounter in this life, then you can stop to see patterns that may be similar to what's happening in your love life now. So being able to identify what's gotten into your psychological love life and what's being replicated is a very important first step.
We pause there for a second?
Yes.
I feel like that would be really hard for people to do, because we say all the time, I mean, you hear people, oh, I'm very self-aware. I'm a very self-aware person. And we kind of wear that as a badge of honor, but we're kind of not, especially when we're talking about things that are unconscious, subconscious. You mentioned implicit, even like these things that are not part of our, say, conscious or deliberate thought process. Like, we're not making a deliberate decision to be defensive, partner. We're not making a deliberate decision like, you know what I want to do today? My intention today is to stir up some controversy so that we maintain distance in our relationship.
No,
and I don't get
offended. It's not like that.
No. So that's hard for people to recognize. Do you find that? And do you find there's ways to help people make that connection?
Yes. I'll tell you what makes it easier. And it might be a little counterintuitive. What makes it easier is multiple hurts.
Ooh.
If I found that if the same thing is hurting you over and over again and you're not being successful at it, there's a large portion of people who will say, okay, I need some help with this. This is hurting me. I'm afraid to make the same mistake over and over again. Something has to be done. They may not know what has to be done. They sometimes come into treatment not knowing that this is where the source of pain is coming from. But I find that it's the disappointment for some people that motivates them to do something. And love itself is a great motivator. I mean, if you make it to your fourth and fifth decade of life and you look back and you say, wow, you know, love life is kind of hard. I'm not doing too good in this area. Your friends have gotten married. They've got families and so on. This is going to hurt. And if that becomes something that you look, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to have to work on my love life. That's a phrase I use a lot these days. Work on your love life. We work on everything else.
Yeah.
Finance, academic, physical life, exercise life. Working on your love life is very important. Let me share with you a theory I have as to why the love life has been neglected.
Yeah.
In the 20th century, we were very careful tampering with the family of origin.
Yeah. Yes.
Domestic violence, walk the guy around the block, put him back in the house. Child abuse, spare the rod, spoil the child. In the 20th century, we were very protective of what went on in the family of origin. That translated into carefulness in our profession about this issue.
Right.
And I'll tell you how. Sigmund Freud. Right? In the turn of the century, with Joseph Breuer, studies in hysteria, what did he discover? He discovered that the Victorian society was gigantically sexually abusive to women and children. He wrote it in the book. 6 months later, he took it back. Uh-oh, this is going to spoil my effort to make psychoanalysis science. So now it's just fantasy. The hysterical women that come into my office talking about sexual abuse are imagining that abuse.
Wow.
What did that do? It made psychoanalysis impotent for 100 years.
Yeah.
Why? Because we weren't looking at real interpersonal trauma.
Right. Yeah.
We were not looking at the family of origin as a place where people can get the most wonderful things in life and the most horrible things in life.
Yeah.
So now in the 21st century, the good news is we're becoming a little more interested in PTSD.
Yep.
Post-trauma. We're now looking at the after effects of trauma. We're trying to figure out how to treat it. People are coming up with different views. I love it. We're a little bit freer now. Here's my position. Interpersonal trauma is the true origin of mental illness.
Wow. Wow. Well, it's such a, especially when you take it back to our most vulnerable years when we're young and the degree of just very basic, like the foundations being poured at that stage. And just at a high level, I talk with people about, because this can be hard for people to accept sometimes, like, no. You know, we don't want to believe it, but that's us. You know, I'm 42 years old. That's me sitting in here with my 42-year-old mind, not realizing that that 42-year-old mind is not the same mind that I had when I was 5, when I was 6 and my dad got diagnosed with cancer, when I was 11 and he passed away and that big void happened and all the result. The mind that I had and the capability for me to make meaning and understand what was happening is so different than an adult. So when we look at these situations and say, no, there's no way that impacted me, we're like negating the fact that learning happens. We're negating the fact that neuroplasticity happens. We're negating the fact that our minds develop from when we're babies up through adulthood. Uh-huh. It's like we ignore all that and assume that the mind I have right now is a fully formed, you know, adult. Was the exact same mind I had back then. It could not have made a difference. Uh-huh. And there's no way that it didn't, right? Like there's no way that it couldn't have.
Absolutely. And so we're on the journey of trying to find out how to respect the family of origin, yet learn what we need to learn from it so that adults can be empowered to make the changes they need to make in their lives. It usually occurs somewhere around middle age. We can, in my experience, we can start to ask questions about the family of origin. I happen to believe our families of origin teach us by the relationships they establish, by observational learning as children. We absorb, internalize quite a bit of what we're observing. And in some instances, instruction. Back in the 60s, I can remember my father, it was waffle morning on Sunday morning. My brothers and I sitting, mother passing out the waffles, father making them. And my father got a bit philosophical. He goes, I hope you guys find a good woman like your mother when it's time to get married. What's that? That's an education.
Yeah, that's an explicit teaching.
Absolutely. And my mother's all smiles, like, I'm the model, right?
Yeah.
But you look back on that and say, wow, you know, there's some teaching going on there. Those lessons are powerful.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. And you were hinting at this earlier when you said it's not easy to make the change. Becoming conscious of it is a process that, like, some people can read my book and get the idea, I got to think a little more about my love life. Let me let me sit down. I even wrote it like a guidebook where you can fill in which unhealthy relationship experiences occurred to you. I wanted people to use it in that way. Easy to read, very explicit, straightforward. But some people might need a little support. That's why my wife and I offer a little telehealth love life consultation work for people who've read the book and want a little support getting through to stage two. From identification, we move to being able to challenge these patterns when you've identified them. And the wonderful thing about being a human being is that we can have what I like to call a therapeutic conflict in our brain and our minds. It's between what we've learned and formed an attachment to and what new learning we understand would be healthier and better.
Yeah.
So there's a period where there's a bit of a conflict between those two in a single mind. So it's important to be able to push against what we've learned that's unhealthy. We've already labeled it as such, and we struggle to disrupt it. And that middle stage can be difficult for people. But I find, for example, in working with patients that empowering people to be able to identify, people will talk, a woman will say to me, you know, I went out with a guy last night. I think he's like the other men that I'm trying to avoid. Let's talk about him. And so we'll talk about him and we'll be working on strengthening her ability to apply her consciousness. Does he say the kinds of things that are red flags for, say, a non-committal man, a man who's not emotionally available, so that she doesn't replicate an abandonment experience she's had and she's replicated a few times in her love life prior. So that ability to look into experience and say, no, I'm not going to let that progress to a dating relationship because he's not eligible. He's not the kind of man. He's a replication guy. He's going to help me replicate something I don't want anymore. So strengthening that ability, kind of weed out what's not healthy and move into the third stage, which I think of, and you probably are aware of, there was a work done in the 40s by Alexander and French wrote a book about the corrective emotional experience. It got a lot of controversy around it and so on. But I believe that new experience is fundamentally corrective. Once we've identified the type of experience we want to avoid, we're in a position to look at the type of experience we want to have and to look at what kind of behaviors, what kind of feelings, what kind of beliefs do I need now? It's almost like a self-study. It's a study of one's own ability to create experience, which I think is wonderful in human beings. We possess that ability. And to use it in a therapeutic way to, let me see if I can create an honest love relationship, because I've created so many dishonest ones. Mm-hmm. I spoke to someone recently who was telling me that she picked three boyfriends who were dishonest in the fact that they cheated on her, and her father cheated on her mother. So there was a little bit of a line of progression there, you know, yeah. that somehow, and these were three different types of men with different personalities, but the common thread was that they were not men who could make a commitment in the long term. So she yeah. was replicating that. So she began a self-study, so to speak, you know, what does an honest man look like? What does an honest person look like? What does honesty feel like? How can I identify an honest man in a group? If I go to a cocktail party, I mean, yeah. to develop the radar so that I can, some signal will go off. Oh, this guy's honest. Or this guy's dishonest. It's a journey into understanding, applying the mind to understanding what new and corrective experiences need to occur so that love life can be shifted in a new direction. And I make a big deal in my book about opposites. If you grew up in a home where there was abandonment, finding people who are emotionally available and committed is the opposite mm-hmm. of abandonment. So it has a corrective element in it. Respect is the opposite of abuse. People who are devoted in a love relationship as opposed to neglect. So the opposites of these unhealthy relationship experiences are important therapeutic momentum in a new direction.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I think it's worth noting some of the reasons why that murky middle, the tricky step two, is this tricky, because it can be, these are all, everybody's got the best of intent, right? And when we look at this stuff at surface level, we can say the example you gave of your patient in the past who kept finding, you know, romantic partners who were alcoholics, for example. Why would you continue to do that?
Yeah.
But we don't realize it goes back to what you were talking about with what we might have learned. You know, people are very, I'm just going to use some, you know, relatable language. People talk a lot about like, oh, comfort zone. And I'm like, from a cognitive perspective, it is familiarity zone.
Yeah.
It might be so uncomfortable.
You hit like, a buzzword. That's wonderful.
Yeah, totally. Familiar. Totally.
The root is family.
Yeah. Ooh. We just family came up with a whole yeah. other thing right there.
There it yes. is. The familiar yeah. is what you've learned from family. It's a dirty yeah. word. It has a positive and a negative implication.
Yeah.
What's familiar could kill you.
Yes.
Or set you free.
Yes. So, and it's so interesting because in our mind, psychologically, familiarity trumps for us venturing out into the unknown, which uh-huh. might be that opposite that you talk about.
Right.
And I would encourage people to think about if this is resonating with you, if you're like, God, I keep dating the same person, or I keep like finding myself in this replicating situation that, you know, Tom, you're talking about, listen to your mind. What is it saying to you? Like, oh, I know he said that, but like, is your mind like fighting in favor of that person who, if you really think about it, you know, probably isn't right? Or is your mind telling you that you are undeserving of the opposite? Or is your, like, what is it? What kind of ick, what kind of chatter, what kind of anxiety, what kind of rumination, what kind of garbage is it throwing you? Because it's a pretty good indication that you've just stepped your toe outside the line of what's familiar. And it might be a good indication that you're going in the right direction.
Yes, yes. And I'll add something to that. Mommy, Daddy. Mommy is a powerful word.
Yeah.
What mommy taught me, what daddy taught me, big brother, big sister, Aunt Mary, mm-hmm. Uncle Joe, these are very important people with a lot of impact. To be able to say, look, I love mommy, but she taught me something unhealthy.
Yes.
I grew up in a home, and I use myself in chapter 5. You know, I drove myself crazy trying to think, what patients am I going to... get some release of confidentiality. Oh, forget it. I'll use my own love life.
You're like, I release myself.
Right.
I don't care. Here's all my garbage.
I'm 69 years old. I can do stuff like that. Right.
Totally.
So I even have a picture of mom, dad, and myself when I was a year and a half years old. These were the people that taught me about love.
Yeah.
Some of it was good. Some of it wasn't. My mother never left home. Her parents lived upstairs. She and four sons lived downstairs. My father worked for my grandparents. She never left home. She never had an opportunity to develop her own individuality, separate from the family. She didn't. She had a lot of unhappiness about that. Yeah. Guess which son sat at the dinner table listening to all the details?
Yeah. Yep.
My mother taught me eligible women were dependent, controlling, and self-centered. Three qualities she struggled with. I learned them from her. Guess what kind of women I went looking for in my love life from the age of 17 to 35?
Yeah.
Dependent, controlling, self-centered. Here's the scary part. If I found someone who was independent, not controlling, not self-centered, I imagined they were.
Wow.
That's how strong the learning is. Until my analyst said, gee whiz, you're using your mom as a template in your love life over and over again for significant disappointment. What?
Yeah.
So I distanced myself from dating, made friends with good friends with a bunch of women I knew, an internship because I didn't have any sisters. So I learned things from them I didn't learn from my mother as a middle-aged man. And when those relationships broke up after about 5 years, my wife showed up, Victoria. We got married, 28 years married. She's independent, not controlling, and intimate, not self-centered.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
That was the experience that I had to make sense out of and say, wait a minute, what can we do here? What can we break down into bit-sized pieces for people to use to even begin the process? Even if you don't get to stage 2 and 3 easily, if you're at stage 1 and you're working on becoming conscious of your love life, you're in a good position. That's beautiful, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. One other bit or piece that I would love to add to it is, as you move into that messy middle, you start to and make those connections, right? So you've made a connection between some of the difficulty you had in your relationships and what you learned from your mom. That can create its own set of dissonance, right? She's my mom and I love my mom, but I'm so angry because it's causing this big issue. I air my dirty laundry on this podcast all the time, and I'm not going to go to too much detail here, but what I will say is I had a similar realization with someone in my family. And what I had to realize is something you alluded to about your mom. I learned these things from that person. That person had their own influences. They learned them from someone else. Those someone else's learned them from someone else.
On and on.
Generationally, things get passed down and they maybe dilute out a little bit or hopefully get better or whatever the case may be. But where I got to with that person is intent matters. I don't think that person sat down and said, you know what I want to do today?
Yeah.
I want to mess with April's romantic relationships for the rest of her life. They didn't. They did the only thing they knew how to do. But I don't know if you found that with people, like where you start to make those connections and all the dissonance roars in because it's so hard to make sense of.
Yeah, I find, and that's why I love the word, learning is user-friendly. We start learning from the beginning. In fact, I'm going to define, and this is my definition of love life. What is a love life? Any and all experiences, relationship experiences involving the emotion of love from the beginning of life to the end. That's your love life. So your love life begins probably before birth in the womb. They're saying some of those interesting works coming out of what do fetuses feel and experience and the stresses they encounter and so on. So love life is based on a learning experience, how we relate. In my book, in my preface, one of the first statements I make is this is not a book about love. This is a book about love relationships, the relationships we form when we fall in love. And that phrase tells you a lot. Fall in love, you're not making love happen. You can't control love. I can't make myself fall out of love. I can't make myself love somebody. Love is a mysterious biological, spiritual, psychological experience. I hope it stays out of our control forever and ever. A mystery of life. People can fall in love more than once, too. Look, the relationship we establish when we fall in love, that we can do something about. And it's a real tragedy. Fall in love. And I think people do this all the time. They fall in love and then they proceed to destroy it.
Yeah.
And they find someone else that helps them do it. What's really mysterious, April, and I think you have a feel for the mysterious parts of this, you know, how does somebody find that other person? Mm-hmm. Who's exactly the type of person I need to destroy my love life?
You're getting at a question that I wanted to ask you. Like, if we circle back to the stats you gave earlier, 50%, 60%, 73% first, second, third marriages, divorce rate. I'm curious about how this all factors into that. Because then there's a 50%, say first marriages, who are not getting divorced. But I wonder, you know, divorce is a decision that we make. It's not necessarily an indicator of the health of the relationship either.
Number might be bigger.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. Because
and if you're not talking about marriage and you're talking about breakups in general, it could be even bigger.
Yeah. Yeah.
A woman came to see me a long time ago. Alcoholic husband she divorced, alcoholic fathers and brothers she experienced. She stayed in treatment to work on recovery from the marriage. Got to a point years later, I'm going to get out there again. Okay, so this is a humorous person, great sense of humor, very witty person. And so I say to her, what happens if I put together a big party, not a drop of alcohol, 49 men invited, one alcoholic, and one man who's an alcoholic, sober as a judge. And I put those 50 men in that party, one woman, you. Are you going to be with that alcoholic at the end of the night?
Wow.
She started laughing. She said, yes, I'll know him a mile away. I'll know him a mile away.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, I think I've been studying this process avidly for a while. I'm not sure it can be explained, except that there are sensors. Feelings are sensors. We have feelings that tell us what things are and how important they are. It's not just cognition. It's not just behavior.
Yeah.
There's feeling. So if I'm next to someone who has a particular problem, a particular aura, I don't know the language that would be suitable. It's just, if this is who they are, I'm going to feel it.
Yeah.
If I'm in my process as deeply as we're talking about it, I'm going to feel that.
Yeah.
But how to describe that process? Maybe it's an emotional form of telepathy. How about that? You know, like a communicational thing that goes on between people that you have to challenge. And I've seen this a lot. You know, somebody gets to the point where he or she says to themselves, look, I got to stop seeing this kind of person. I got to stop looking for this kind of person. It's a replication. I've understood all that we've talked about. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop doing it. So they venture out into the dating world, and people, like they don't want to meet, come at them one after another. It's almost like they know that this is a person who's made a fresh change in themselves. So they're trying to get to the older part mm-hmm. of them. Mm-hmm. So they show up, and the patient comes in and tells me, you know, it's really weird. I went to a party last night and I met three people, and they were exactly like my ex-wife. Oh my God, I got to tell the host, I'm leaving a little early tonight. You know, I'm not having a good experience here. But I mean, how do you explain that? I say things like, hang in there, you know, I mean, the probabilities are there, you know, like maybe another opposite type of person will show up before you know it.
Play the numbers game.
Yeah, right. Awareness. That's the point you made earlier. Now the intention is there.
Yeah.
Shifted and focused. Let me look at this openly, honestly, and real. And I think that makes a gigantic difference.
I could go down so many rabbit holes. Like I'm very proud of myself that I've sidestepped a few of them. We've gone down a few, but uh-huh. I've sidestepped a few in the interest of keeping this a manageable sized episode. But one thing that I want to ask as we're kind of winding down is, you know, we talked a little bit about that generational nature, right? Like we learn from our families of origin. You hear a lot right now about, and there's a lot of societal and just factors that are influencing this, about generations, call them the XY generations, being a very big pivot generation. We've learned a lot about psychology. It has filtered its way into just society more broadly. We've also had a number of just political, societal, environmental, like cultural events that have also catalyzed those two generations saying, hold on, I understand that I might have learned something from my family of origin, and now here I am. What advice do you have for them to, with the right intention, almost do better by the next generation? Asking for a mom of two girls, what can we think about in terms of what we model in our relationships to set our kids up to be better, or the way that we even relate to our kids, to continue to pivot in the right direction, to move in a direction that's more effective and healthy generationally versus sort of living out this thing that has been passed down, this difficulty that's been passed down?
You're asking an extremely important question. I'm going to try to answer it in a way that reflects my personal beliefs about the family and how these things get moved from one generation to another. I'm the parent of a son. I have a 23-year-old son, and I've witnessed his transformation through the lifespan so far. And I've recognized that an important issue that oftentimes gets lost, too often gets lost, is the individuality of the person versus what we want to impart to them. Ideally, in my opinion, our job as parents, as a family, is to launch our children into adulthood. Okay? I think most people would agree with that. Most. Some might not. Some might believe that we should keep our children in an orbit around the family of origin. But I believe that separation from the family of origin into an independent adulthood is an aspect of maturity and health. Being able to recognize, this is the hard part, the unique individuality of our children is a problem. It's a problem that parents fall into honestly because we love our kids.
Yeah.
We want them to get the best out of life. We don't want them to suffer. We don't like it when they fall down. We want to protect them as much as possible. If you're a caring parent, this is what you want. Yeah. But unfortunately, sometimes when we protect our children, we don't allow them to have the experiences they need to develop themselves. Sometimes we get in the way. We can get in the way physically. We can get in the way psychologically.
Yeah.
And this brings us close to your question. How do we get in the way psychologically? If we're transferring unhealthy patterns from one generation to the other, that's a good example of getting in the way psychologically in an unhealthy way. Recognizing the unique individuality of our children, I wrote a book in 1999, Individuation in Contemporary Psychoanalysis. I'm very interested from the work of Eric Fromm. I worked with a man, an analyst by the name of Benjamin Wallstein, who was a supervisee of Eric Fromm, and worked with Clara Thompson, the psychiatrist who was the American psychiatrist. And these people had ideas about individuality, unique individuality, and psychological individuation. That maturation wasn't just bringing in other people's viewpoints. Psychological strength wasn't just incorporating, internalizing other people's viewpoints.
Right.
It was more importantly allowing one's unique individuality to emerge and become the foundation of one's existence and one's interpersonal life. And that is true psychological strength, because now who you really are, your true self, is the foundation of your life, emotionally and otherwise. And that process is called psychological individuation. What's interesting is that, for example, Margaret Mahler, back, I believe it was in the 70s, she defined individuation as taking bits and pieces of what our parents teach us, putting it in our mind, and individuating based on that. But the people I just cited argued with that and said, no. We use other people to grow up, but that's not who we are. We use them. I can internalize mom and dad as part of that process of maturation, but there's a point in my life where becoming who I am, recognizing my uniqueness, my individuality, that's a sturdier, more authentic foundation to my psychological life. So I would define the question you ask, which is, what is psychological strength, as a process of individuation in one's life, being able to do that. Now, when does it take place? I would love to sit here and tell you, April, that there are tons of families that individuate their children from young. 5-year-old kid and mom says, never mind what I'm saying. It's what you want for yourself that's important. Let me teach my child about the uniqueness of their individuality when they're young so that they can harness that energy and that understanding. It doesn't happen that often in my experience. Mm-hmm. What happens instead is middle-aged people get to a point where they say, wait a minute, I want to own my own life. I want to find out, and here's a big middle-aged question, who am I?
Yeah.
That is code word for I need to psychologically individuate.
Yeah. That's so good. This has been amazing. There's so much in this conversation that connects to, I mean, just every facet of our day-to-day lives, but some of the most important, what can be psychologically protective relationships that we have in our lives. And I'm just so appreciative of you coming on and being with us. Where can people learn more about you, learn more about your book, your work, all of that?
I have a blog website called the Love Life Learning Center.com. lovelifelearningcenter.com. There are a bunch of posts on there. I wanted it to be an online library of sorts, you know, where people could find articles on the real love life stuff, not the flowery stuff, but the, you know. So you'll find information about my wife and I and our work, as well as the book. The book's on Amazon and other book distributors. But that's the center place, the lovelifelearningcenter.com.
Perfect. I'll make sure I link that up on this episode description, on your show notes page, so that folks, if you're listening to this, you and you're interested, you can just swipe up on your device and click and get right there. Tom, this is amazing. It's such a cool blending of psychoanalysis and the cognitive stuff that I nerd out on. And it's all interconnected. Uh-huh. I feel like I joke with other psychologists sometimes. I'm like, maybe there's only like three things that psychology has to say, but we all say it in a little bit of a different way. So it feels like a really broad field, but we really only have like three things to say. Feels like sometimes.
We should all speak the same language at some point. You know,
I know, but whatever.
If 100 years from now, maybe.
Yeah. If we all say things in slightly different ways, maybe it'll resonate with more people. But I'm just so appreciative of you coming on and doing this work and taking such care to take some of these conceptual issues and make them very practical for people. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. Absolutely. I learned something in every podcast and I had a great time in this one. Thank you so much.
You bet. All right, friends, stay with me for a couple more minutes. I've got a few resources to send your way, especially that link to Tom's book and his blog. We'll make sure we get that in the additional resources, but a couple more things for you to consider. Hang out for just a second and I'll be right back. All right. Oh my gosh, that conversation got so deep. It was so hard to avoid some of the rabbit holes that I wanted to go down. That was a lot of self-control on my part. I'm really proud of myself. I'm just going to give myself a round of applause. If you're not going to celebrate yourself, who is, right? I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Thomas Jordan. Man, there are some cool connections there that we have spoken about on other episodes. Some of them are very, very old. And so I want to make sure you get a few resources. First of all, the link to lovelifelearningcenter.com is in the additional resources section of this episode description. If you're interested in any of that, click in there. You can get to all of Dr. Jordan's stuff. I highly suggest it. This is just, it's such a revolutionary, but such a cool way to think about our romantic relationships. Second, I did an episode with the founders of A Deeper Way quite a while ago. It's called Six Principles of Meaningful Relationships. This is like some fundamental foundational stuff. Like if you're going to have a meaningful, reciprocal, open, healthy relationship with people, there are six principles that need to be in place. And I would highly suggest you check out that episode to just give yourself more food for thought, especially when you're thinking about that first step that Dr. Jordan talked about. So how do we become more self-aware of the problem areas in our relationships? This might give you some, I guess, more food for thought as you start to think about how you're currently showing up or what's currently happening inside your romantic relationships. So I wanted to share that one, Six Principles of Meaningful Relationships. Third resource that I have for you. This is an old episode. This is episode, 106. This might even be a legacy episode from before I rebranded the podcast to Building Psychological Strength. P.S. If you're new to me or you haven't been here since the beginning, hey, OGs, this podcast used to be branded Women Inspired. And so way back in the day, I featured only inspiring women. I've branched out to do back to the stuff that I absolutely love around psychology, but this was a legacy episode. So it'll sound a little bit different. Regardless, the interview part of it is so important. This is with a woman named Sylvie Kukasian. She is an expert in the realm of attachment. So how your attachment style impacts your relationships. I can't stress enough how important this is. We I told you there was a lot of landmines and not landmines, but like rabbit holes we didn't go down on this episode. This is one of them. We flirted with this topic so many times and I'm like, don't do it. You can share the other episode. It's going to be okay. They're going to get the information. So please do me a favor. Go listen to that episode. Sylvie is very active on Instagram and social media. So go to that episode and connect with her on Instagram. Man, she shares some really helpful information. So, how your attachment style impacts your relationships, episode 106, going to sound different from today's format of the podcast, but so worth listening to. Friends, I'm so thrilled that you joined me for yet another week of the podcast. It means everything to me to have you in this community. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much for being here. And please share this with somebody else who might benefit from it. It would mean so much to me, and I think it would mean a lot to them to know that you're thinking about them and supporting their growth and development as well. And finally, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet, and I'm grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I will see you next week.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.